very dangerous butler. He'd loaded some of his grandmother's porcelain in a wagon and toted it into the yard, where he set up targets on old fence posts at the edge of the property. He'd been shooting so long, his fingers were starting to lose their feeling. With every arrow, he imagined he was striking down his problems. Snipers in Afghanistan. Smash. A teapot exploded with an arrow through the middle. The sacrifice medal, a silver disc on a red and black ribbon, given for death in the line of duty, presented to Frank as if it were something important, something that made everything all right. Thwack. A teacup spun into the woods. The officer who came to tell him, "Your mother is a hero. Captain Emily Jong died trying to save her comrades." Crack. A blue and white plate split into pieces. His grandmother's chastisement. "Men do not cry, especially Jong men. You will endure, Fi." No one called him Fi except his grandmother. "What sort of name is Frank?" she would scold. "That is not a Chinese name." "I'm not Chinese," Frank thought, but he didn't dare say that. His mother had told him years ago, "There is no arguing with grandmother. It'll only make you suffer worse." She'd been right. And now Frank had no one except his grandmother. Thud. A fourth arrow hit the fence post and stuck there, quivering. "Fi," said his grandmother. Frank turned. She was clutching a shoebox-sized mahogany chest that Frank had never seen before. With her high-collared black dress and severe bun of gray hair, she looked like a schoolteacher from the 1800s. She surveyed the carnage. Her porcelain in the wagon, the shards of her favorite tea sets scattered over the lawn, Frank's arrow sticking out of the ground, the trees, the fence posts, and one in the head of a smiling garden gnome. Frank thought she would yell or hit him with the box. He'd never done anything this bad before. He'd never felt so angry. Grandmother's face was full of bitterness and disapproval. She looked nothing like Frank's mom. He wondered how his mother had turned out to be so nice, always laughing, always gentle. Frank couldn't imagine his mom growing up with grandmother any more than he could imagine her on the battlefield, though the two situations probably weren't that different. He waited for grandmother to explode. Maybe he'd be grounded and wouldn't have to go to the funeral. He wanted to hurt her for being so mean all the time, for letting his mother go off to war, for scolding him to get over it. All she cared about was her stupid collection. "Stop this ridiculous behavior," grandmother said. She didn't sound very irritated. "It is beneath you." To Frank's astonishment, she kicked aside one of her favorite teacups. "The car will be here soon," she said. "We must talk." Frank was dumbfounded. He looked more closely at the mahogany box. For a horrible moment, he wondered if it contained his mother's ashes, but that was impossible. Grandmother had told him there would be a military burial. Then why did grandmother hold the box so gingerly, as if its contents grieved her? "Come inside," she said. Without waiting to see if he would follow, she turned and marched toward the house. In the parlor, Frank sat on a velvet sofa, surrounded by vintage family photos, porcelain vases that had been too large for his wagon, and red Chinese calligraphy banners. Frank didn't know what the calligraphy said. He'd never had much interest in learning. He didn't know most of the people in the photographs either. Whenever grandmother started lecturing him about his ancestors, how they'd come over from China and prospered in the import-export business, eventually becoming one of the wealthiest Chinese families in Vancouver, well, it was boring. Frank was fourth-generation Canadian. He didn't care about China and all these musty antiques. The only Chinese characters he could recognize were his family name, Zhang, Master of Bows. That was cool. Grandmother sat next to him, her posture stiff, her hands folded over the box. "Your mother wanted you to have this," she said with reluctance. "She kept it since you were a baby. When she went away to the war, she entrusted it to me. But now she is gone, and soon you will be going too." Frank's stomach fluttered. "Going? Where?" "I am old," grandmother said, as if that were a surprising announcement. I have my own appointment with death soon enough. I cannot teach you the skills you will need, and I cannot keep this burden. If something were to happen to it, I would never forgive myself. You would die.
Frank wasn't sure he'd heard her right. It sounded like she had said his life depended on that box. He wondered why he'd never seen it before. She must have kept it locked in the attic, the one room Frank was forbidden to explore. She'd always said she kept her most valuable treasures up there.
She handed the box to him. He opened the lid with trembling fingers. Inside, cushioned in velvet lining, was a terrifying, life-altering, incredibly important piece of wood. It looked like driftwood, hard and smooth, sculpted into a wavy shape. It was about the size of a TV remote control. The tip was charred. Frank touched the burned end. It still felt warm. The ashes left a black smudge on his finger.
"It's a stick," he said.
He couldn't figure out why Grandmother was acting so tense and serious about it. Her eyes glittered. "Fi, do you know of prophecies? Do you know of the gods?" The questions made him uncomfortable. He thought about Grandmother's silly gold statues of Chinese immortals, her superstitions about putting furniture in certain places and avoiding unlucky numbers. Prophecies made him think of fortune cookies, which weren't even Chinese, not really. But the bullies at school teased him about stupid stuff like that. "Confucius say," all that garbage. Frank had never even been to China. He wanted nothing to do with it. But of course, Grandmother didn't want to hear that.
"A little, Grandmother," he said. "Not much."
"Most would have scoffed at your mother's tale," she said. "But I did not. I know of prophecies and gods, Greek, Roman, Chinese. They intertwine in our family. I did not question what she told me about your father."
"Wait, what?"
"Your father was a god," she said plainly.
If Grandmother had had a sense of humor, Frank would have thought she was kidding. But Grandmother never teased. Was she going senile?
"Stop gaping at me," she snapped. "My mind is not addled. Haven't you ever wondered why your father never came back?"
"He was..."
Frank faltered. Losing his mother was painful enough. He didn't want to think about his father, too.
"He was in the army like Mom. He went missing in action, in Iraq."
"Bah! He was a god. He fell in love with your mother because she was a natural warrior. She was like me, strong, brave, good, beautiful."
Strong and brave, Frank could believe. Picturing Grandmother as good or beautiful was more difficult. He still suspected she might be losing her marbles, but he asked,
"What kind of god?"
"Roman," she said. "Beyond that, I don't know. Your mother wouldn't say, or perhaps she didn't know herself. It is no surprise a god would fall in love with her, given our family. He must have known she was of ancient blood."
"Wait, we're Chinese. Why would Roman gods want to date Chinese Canadians?"
Grandmother's nostrils flared.
"If you bother to learn the family history, Fi, you might know this. China and Rome are not so different, nor as separate as you might believe. Our family is from Gansu province, a town called Lijian. And before that, as I said, ancient blood. The blood of princes and heroes."
Frank just stared at her. She sighed in exasperation.
"My words are wasted on this young ox. You will learn the truth when you go to camp. Perhaps your father will claim you. But for now, I must explain the firewood."
She pointed at the big stone fireplace.
"Shortly after you were born, a visitor appeared at our hearth. Your mother and I sat here on the couch, just where you and I are sitting. You were a tiny thing, swaddled in a blue blanket, and she cradled you in her arms."
It sounded like a sweet memory, but Grandmother told it in a bitter tone, as if she knew even then that Frank would turn into a big lumbering oaf.
"A woman appeared at the fire," she continued. "She was a white woman, a Guaipo, dressed in blue silk, with a strange cloak like the skin of a goat."
"A goat?" Frank said numbly.
Grandmother scowled.
"Yes, Clean your ears, Fai Zhong. I'm too old to tell every story twice. The woman with the goat skin was a goddess. I can always tell these things. She smiled at the baby, at you, and she told your mother, in perfect Mandarin no less, he will close the circle. He will return your family to its roots and bring you great honor.
Grandmother snorted. I do not argue with goddesses, but perhaps this one did not see the future clearly.
Whatever the case, she said, he will go to camp and restore your reputation there. He will free Thanatos from his icy chains.
Wait, who?
Thanatos, Grandmother said impatiently. The Greek name for death. Now may I continue without interruptions? The goddess said, the blood of Pelos is strong in this child from his mother's side. He will have the Zhong family gift, but he will also have the powers of his father.
Suddenly Frank's family history didn't seem so boring. He desperately wanted to ask what it all meant. Powers, gifts, blood of Pelos. What was this camp, and who was his father?
But he didn't want to interrupt Grandmother again. He wanted her to keep talking.
No power comes without a price, Fai, she said. Before the goddess disappeared, she pointed at the fire and said, he will be the strongest of your clan and the greatest, but the fates have decreed he will also be the most vulnerable. His life will burn bright and short. As soon as that piece of tinder is consumed, that stick at the edge of the fire, your son is destined to die.
Frank could hardly breathe. He looked at the box in his lap and the smudge of ash on his finger. The story sounded ridiculous. But suddenly the piece of driftwood seemed more sinister, colder and heavier.
This...
Yes, my thick-headed ox, Grandmother said. That is the very stick. The goddess disappeared and I snatched the wood from the fire immediately. We have kept it ever since.
If it burns up, I die?
It is not so strange, Grandmother said. Roman, Chinese, the destinies of men can often be predicted, and sometimes guarded against, at least for a time. The firewood is in your possession now. Keep it close. As long as it is safe, you are safe.
Frank shook his head. He wanted to protest that this was just a stupid legend. Maybe Grandmother was trying to scare him as some sort of revenge for breaking her porcelain. But her eyes were defiant. She seemed to be challenging Frank. If you do not believe it, burn it. Frank closed the box.
If it's so dangerous, why not seal the wood in something that won't burn, like plastic or steel? Why not put it in a safe deposit box?
What would happen, Grandmother wondered, if we coated the stick in another substance? Would you, too, suffocate? I do not know. Your mother would not take the risk. She couldn't bear to part with it, for fear something would go wrong. Banks can be robbed. Buildings can burn down. Strange things conspire when one tries to cheat fate. Your mother thought the stick was only safe in her possession until she went to war. Then she gave it to me.
Grandmother exhaled sourly.
Emily was foolish, going to war. Though I suppose I always knew it was her destiny, she hoped to meet your father again.
She thought he'd be in Afghanistan?
Grandmother spread her hands, as if this was beyond her understanding.
She went, she died bravely. She thought the family gift would protect her. No doubt that's how she saved those soldiers. But the gift has never kept our family safe. It did not help my father or his father. It did not help me. And now you have become a man. You must follow the path.
But what path? What's our gift? Archery?
You and your archery, foolish boy. Soon you will find out. Tonight, after the funeral, you must go south. Your mother said if she did not come back from combat, Lupa would send messengers. They will escort you to a place where the children of the gods can be trained for their destiny.
Frank felt as if he were being shot with arrows, his heart splitting into porcelain shards.
He didn't understand most of what Grandmother said, but one thing was clear. She was kicking him out.
"You just let me go?" he asked. "Your last family?"
Grandmother's mouth quivered. Her eyes looked moist. Frank was shocked to realize she was near tears. She'd lost her husband years ago, then her daughter, and now she was about to send away her only grandson. But she rose from the couch and stood tall, her posture as stiff and correct as ever.
"When you arrive at camp," she instructed, "you must speak to the praetor in private. Tell her your great-grandfather was Shen Lun."
"It has been many years since the San Francisco incident. Hopefully they will not kill you for what he did, but you might want to beg forgiveness for his actions."
"This is sounding better and better," Frank mumbled.
"The goddess said you would bring our family full circle."
Grandmother's voice had no trace of sympathy. "She chose your path years ago, and it will not be easy. But now it is time for the funeral. We have obligations. Come, the car will be waiting."
The ceremony was a blur. Solemn faces, the patter of rain on the graveside awning, the crack of rifles from the honor guard, the casket sinking into the earth. That night, the wolves came. They howled on the front porch. Frank came out to meet them. He took his travel pack, his warmest clothes, his bow and his quiver. His mother's sacrifice medal was tucked in his pack. The charred stick was wrapped carefully in three layers of cloth in his coat pocket, next to his heart. His journey south began, to the wolf house in Sonoma, and eventually to Camp Jupiter, where he spoke to Raina privately as Grandmother had instructed. He begged forgiveness for the great-grandfather he knew nothing about. Raina let him join the Legion. She never did tell him what his great-grandfather had done, but she obviously knew. Frank could tell it was bad.
"I judge people by their own merits," Raina had told him, "but do not mention the name Shen Lun to anyone else. It must remain our secret, or you'll be treated badly."
Unfortunately, Frank didn't have many merits. His first month at camp was spent knocking over rows of weapons, breaking chariots, and tripping entire cohorts as they marched. His favorite job was caring for Hannibal, the elephant. But he'd managed to mess that up, too, giving Hannibal indigestion by feeding him peanuts. Who knew elephants could be peanut intolerant? Frank figured Raina was regretting her decision to let him join. Every day he woke up wondering if the stick would somehow catch fire and burn, and he would cease to exist. All of this ran through Frank's head as he walked with Hazel and Percy to the war games. He thought about the stick wrapped inside his coat pocket and what it meant that Juno had appeared at camp. Was he about to die? He hoped not. He hadn't brought his family any honor yet, that was for sure. Maybe Apollo would claim him today and explain his powers and gifts. Once they got out of camp, the fifth cohort formed two lines behind their centurions, Dakota and Gwen. They marched north, skirting the edge of the city, and headed to the Field of Mars, the largest, flattest part of the valley. The grass was cropped short by all the unicorns, bulls, and homeless fawns that grazed here. The earth was pitted with explosion craters and scarred with trenches from past games. At the north end of the field stood their target. The engineers had built a stone fortress with an iron portcullis, guard towers, scorpion ballistae, water cannons, and no doubt many other nasty surprises for the defenders to use.
"They did a good job today," Hazel noted. "That's bad for us."
"Wait," Percy said. "You're telling me that fortress was built today?" Hazel grinned.
"Legionnaires are trained to build. If we had to, we could break down the entire camp and rebuild it somewhere else. Take maybe 3 or 4 days, but we could do it."
"Let's not," Percy said. "So you attack a different fort every night?"
"Not every night," Frank said. "We have different training exercises. Sometimes death ball, which is like paintball, except with, you know, poison and acid and fireballs. Sometimes we do chariots and gladiator competitions. Sometimes war games." Hazel pointed at the fort.
"Somewhere inside, the first and second cohorts are keeping their banners. Our job is to get inside and capture them without getting slaughtered. We do that, we win."
Percy's eyes lit up.
Like Capture the Flag. I think I like Capture the Flag.
Frank laughed.
Yeah, well, it's harder than it sounds. We have to get past those scorpions and water cannons on the walls, fight through the inside of the fortress, find the banners, and defeat the guards, all while protecting our own banners and troops from capture. And our cohort is in competition with the other two attacking cohorts. We sort of work together, but not really. The cohort that captures the banners gets all the glory.
Percy stumbled, trying to keep time with the left-right marching rhythm. Frank sympathized. He'd spent his first 2 weeks falling down.
So why are we practicing this anyway? Percy asked. Do you guys spend a lot of time laying siege to fortified cities?
Teamwork, Hazel said. Quick thinking, tactics, battle skills. You'd be surprised what you can learn in the war games.
Like who will stab you in the back, Frank said.
Especially that, Hazel agreed.
They marched to the center of the Field of Mars and formed ranks. The third and fourth cohorts assembled as far as possible from the fifth. The centurions for the attacking side gathered for a conference. In the sky above them, Reyna circled on her Pegasus, Scipio, ready to play referee. Half a dozen giant eagles flew in formation behind her, prepared for ambulance airlift duty if necessary. The only person not participating in the game was Nico D'Angelo, Pluto's ambassador, who had climbed an observation tower about 100 yards from the fort and would be watching with binoculars. Frank propped his pilum against his shield and checked Percy's armor. Every strap was correct. Every piece of armor was properly adjusted.
You did it right, he said in amazement. Percy, you must have done war games before.
I don't know. Maybe.
The only thing that wasn't regulation was Percy's glowing bronze sword. Not imperial gold and not a gladius. The blade was leaf-shaped, and the writing on the hilt was Greek. Looking at it made Frank uneasy. Percy frowned.
We can use real weapons, right?
Yeah, Frank agreed. For sure. I've just never seen a sword like that.
What if I hurt somebody?
We heal them, Frank said. Or try to. The Legion medics are pretty good with ambrosia and nectar and unicorn draft.
No one dies, Hazel said. Well, not usually. And if they do...
Frank imitated the voice of Vitellius.
They're wimps. Back in my day, we died all the time and we liked it.
Hazel laughed.
Just stay with us, Percy. Chances are we'll get the worst duty and get eliminated early. They'll throw us at the walls first to soften up the defenses. Then the third and fourth cohorts will march in and get the honors, if they can even breach the fort.
Horns blew. Dakota and Gwen walked back from the officers' conference looking grim.
All right, here's the plan.
Dakota took a quick swig of Kool-Aid from his travel flask.
They're throwing us at the walls first to soften up the defenses.
The whole cohort groaned.
I know, Gwen said. But maybe this time we'll have some luck.
Leave it to Gwen to be the optimist. Everybody liked her because she took care of her people and tried to keep their spirits up. She could even control Dakota during his hyperactive bug juice fits. Still, the campers grumbled and complained. Nobody believed in luck for the fifth.
First line with Dakota, Gwen said. Lock shields and advance in turtle formation to the main gates. Try to stay in one piece. Draw their fire. Second line.
Gwen turned to Frank's row without much enthusiasm.
U-17 from Bobby Over. Take charge of the elephant and the scaling ladders. Try a flanking attack on the western wall. Maybe we can spread the defenders too thin. Frank, Hazel, Percy. Well, just do whatever. Show Percy the ropes. Try to keep him alive.
She turned back to the whole cohort.
If anybody gets over the wall first, I'll make sure you get the mural crown. Victory for the fifth!
The cohort cheered half-heartedly and broke ranks. Percy frowned.
Do whatever?
Yeah, Hazel sighed. Big vote of confidence.
What's the mural crown? He asked.
Military medal, Frank said.
He'd been forced to memorize all the possible awards.
Big honor for the first soldier to breach an enemy fort. You'll notice nobody in the fifth is wearing one.
Usually we don't even get into the fort because we're burning or drowning or...
He faltered and looked at Percy.
Water cannons?
What?
Percy asked.
The cannons on the walls, Frank said. They draw water from the aqueduct. There's a pump system. Heck, I don't know how they work, but they're under a lot of pressure.
If you could control them, like you controlled the river...
Frank, Hazel beamed. That's brilliant.
Percy didn't look so sure.
I don't know how I did that at the river. I'm not sure I can control the cannons from this far away.
We'll get you closer.
Frank pointed to the eastern wall of the fort, where the 5th cohort wouldn't be attacking.
That's where the defense will be the weakest. They'll never take 3 kids seriously. I think we can sneak up pretty close before they see us.
Sneak up how?
Percy asked.
Frank turned to Hazel. Can you do that thing again?
She punched him in the chest.
You said you wouldn't tell anybody.
Immediately Frank felt terrible. He'd gotten so caught up in the idea. Hazel muttered under her breath.
Never mind. It's fine. Percy, he's talking about the trenches. The field of Mars is riddled with tunnels from over the years. Some are collapsed or buried deep, but a lot of them are still passable. I'm pretty good at finding them and using them. I can even collapse them if I have to.
Like you did with the Gorgons, Percy said.
To slow them down.
Frank nodded approvingly.
I told you Pluto is cool. He's the god of everything under the earth. Hazel can find caves, tunnels, trapdoors.
And it was our secret, she grumbled.
Frank felt himself blushing.
Yeah, sorry.
But if we can get close...
And if I can knock out the water cannons...
Percy nodded, like he was warming to the idea.
What do we do then?
Frank checked his quiver. He always stocked up on special arrows. He'd never gotten to use them before, but maybe tonight was the night. Maybe he could finally do something good enough to get Apollo's attention.
The rest is up to me, he said. Let's go.
Chapter 11. Frank. Frank had never felt so sure of anything, which made him nervous. Nothing he planned ever went right. He always managed to break, ruin, burn, sit on, or knock over something important. Yet he knew this strategy would work. Hazel found them a tunnel with no problem. In fact, Frank had a sneaking suspicion she didn't just find tunnels. It was as though tunnels manufactured themselves to suit her needs. Passages that had been filled in years ago suddenly unfilled, changing direction to lead Hazel where she wanted to go. They crept along by the light of Percy's glowing sword, Riptide. Above, they heard the sounds of battle, kids shouting, Hannibal the elephant bellowing with glee, scorpion bolts exploding, and water cannons firing. The tunnel shook, dirt rained down on them. Frank slipped his hand inside the armor. The piece of wood was still safe and secure in his coat pocket, though one good shot from a scorpion might set his lifeline on fire. Bad, Frank, he chided himself. Fire is the F word. Don't think about it.
There's an opening just ahead, Hazel announced. We'll come up 10 feet from the east wall.
How can you tell? Percy asked.
I don't know, she said, but I'm sure.
Could we tunnel straight under the wall? Frank wondered.
No, Hazel said. The engineers were smart. They built the walls on old foundations that go down to bedrock. And don't ask how I know. I just do.
Frank stumbled over something and cursed. Percy brought his sword around for more light. The thing Frank had tripped on was gleaming silver. He crouched down.
Don't touch it,
Hazel said. Frank's hand stopped a few inches from the chunk of metal. It looked like a giant Hershey's Kiss, about the size of his fist.
It's massive, he said.
Silver?
Platinum.
Hazel sounded scared out of her wits.
It'll go away in a second. Please don't touch it. It's dangerous.
Frank didn't understand how a lump of metal could be dangerous, but he took Hazel seriously. As they watched, the chunk of platinum sank into the ground. He stared at Hazel.
How did you know?
In the light of Percy's sword, Hazel looked as ghostly as a lar.
I'll explain later, she promised.
Another explosion rocked the tunnel, and they forged ahead.
They popped out of a hole just where Hazel had predicted. In front of them, the fort's east wall loomed. Off to their left, Frank could see the main line of the 5th cohort advancing in turtle formation, shields forming a shell over their heads and sides. They were trying to reach the main gates, but the defenders above pelted them with rocks and shot flaming bolts from the scorpions, blasting craters around their feet. A water cannon discharged with a jaw-rattling thrum, and a jet of liquid carved a trench in the dirt right in front of the cohort. Percy whistled.
That's a lot of pressure, all right.
The 3rd and 4th cohorts weren't even advancing. They stood back and laughed, watching their allies get beat up. The defenders clustered on the wall above the gates, yelling insults at the tortoise formation as it staggered back and forth. War games had deteriorated into beat up the 5th. Frank's vision went red with anger.
Let's shake things up.
He reached in his quiver and pulled out an arrow heavier than the rest. The iron tip was shaped like the nose cone of a rocket. An ultra-thin gold rope trailed from the fletching. Shooting it accurately up the wall would take more force and skill than most archers could manage, but Frank had strong arms and good aim. Maybe Apollo is watching, he thought hopefully.
What does that do? Percy asked. Grappling hook?
It's called a Hydra arrow, Frank said. Can you knock out the water cannons?
A defender appeared on the wall above them.
Hey! He shouted to his buddies. Check it out! More victims!
Percy, Frank said,
now would be good.
More kids came across the battlements to laugh at them. A few ran to the nearest water cannon and swung the barrel toward Frank. Percy closed his eyes. He raised his hand. Up on the wall, somebody yelled,
Open wide, losers!
Kaboom! The cannon exploded in a starburst of blue, green, and white. Defenders screamed as a watery shockwave flattened them against the battlements. Kids toppled over the walls but were snatched by giant eagles and carried to safety. Then the entire eastern wall shuddered as the explosion backed up through the pipelines. One after another, the water cannons on the battlements exploded. The scorpions' fires were doused. Defenders scattered in confusion or were tossed through the air, giving the rescue eagles quite a workout. At the main gates, the 5th cohort forgot about their formation. Mystified, they lowered their shields and stared at the chaos. Frank shot his arrow. It streaked upward, carrying its glittering rope. When it reached the top, the metal point fractured into a dozen lines that lashed out and wrapped around anything they could find. Parts of the wall, a scorpion, a broken water cannon, and a couple of defending campers, who yelped and found themselves slammed against the battlements as anchors. From the main rope, handholds extended at 2-foot intervals, making a ladder.
Go!
Frank said. Percy grinned.
You first, Frank. This is your party.
Frank hesitated. Then he slung his bow on his back and began to climb. He was halfway up before the defenders recovered their senses enough to sound the alarm. Frank glanced back at 5th cohort's main group. They were staring up at him, dumbfounded.
Well?
Frank screamed.
Attack!
Gwen was the first to unfreeze. She grinned and repeated the order. A cheer went up from the battlefield. Hannibal the elephant trumpeted with happiness, but Frank couldn't afford to watch. He clambered to the top of the wall, where 3 defenders were trying to hack down his rope ladder. One good thing about being big, clumsy, and clad in metal, Frank was like a heavily armored bowling ball. He launched himself at the defenders, and they toppled like pins. Frank got to his feet. He took command of the battlements, sweeping his pilum back and forth and knocking down defenders. Some shot arrows, some tried to get under his guard with their swords, but Frank felt unstoppable. Then Hazel appeared next to him, swinging her big cavalry sword like she was born for battle. Percy leaped onto the wall and raised Riptide.
Fun, he said.
Together they cleared the defenders off the walls. Below them, the gates broke. Hannibal barreled into the fort, arrows and rocks bouncing harmlessly off his Kevlar armor. The 5th cohort charged in behind the elephant, and the battle went hand to hand. Finally, from the edge of the field of Mars, a battle cry went up. The 3rd and 4th cohorts ran to join the fight. A little late,
Hazel grumbled.
We can't let them get the banners, Frank said.
No, Percy agreed. Those are ours.
No more talk was necessary. They moved like a team, as if the three of them had been working together for years. They rushed down the interior steps and into the enemy base. Chapter 12. Frank. After that, the battle was mayhem. Frank, Percy, and Hazel waded through the enemy, plowing down anyone who stood in their way. The first and second cohorts, pride of Camp Jupiter, a well-oiled, highly disciplined war machine, fell apart under the assault and the sheer novelty of being on the losing side. Part of their problem was Percy. He fought like a demon, whirling through the defenders' ranks in a completely unorthodox style, rolling under their feet, slashing with his sword instead of stabbing like a Roman would, whacking campers with the flat of his blade, and generally causing mass panic. Octavian screamed in a shrill voice, maybe ordering the first cohort to stand their ground, maybe trying to sing soprano. But Percy put a stop to it. He somersaulted over a line of shields and slammed the butt of his sword into Octavian's helmet. The centurion collapsed like a sock puppet. Frank shot arrows until his quiver was empty, using blunt-tipped missiles that wouldn't kill but left some nasty bruises. He broke his pilum over a defender's head, then reluctantly drew his gladius. Meanwhile, Hazel climbed onto Hannibal's back. She charged toward the center of the fort, grinning down at her friends.
"Let's go, slowpokes!"
"Gods of Olympus, she's beautiful," Frank thought. They ran to the center of the base. The inner keep was virtually unguarded. Obviously, the defenders never dreamed an assault would get this far. Hannibal busted down the huge doors. Inside, the first and second cohort standard bearers were sitting around a table playing mythomagic with cards and figurines. The cohort's emblems were propped carelessly against one wall. Hazel and Hannibal rode straight into the room, and the standard bearers fell backward out of their chairs. Hannibal stepped on the table, and game pieces scattered. By the time the rest of the cohort caught up with them, Percy and Frank had disarmed the enemies, grabbed the banners, and climbed onto Hannibal's back with Hazel. They marched out of the keep triumphantly with the enemy colors. The fifth cohort formed ranks around them. Together they paraded out of the fort, past stunned enemies and lines of equally mystified allies. Reyna circled low overhead on her Pegasus.
"The game is won!"
She sounded as if she were trying not to laugh.
"Assemble for honors!"
Slowly the campers regrouped on the field of Mars. Frank saw plenty of minor injuries, some burns, broken bones, black eyes, cuts and gashes, plus a lot of very interesting hairdos from fires and exploding water cannons, but nothing that couldn't be fixed. He slid off the elephant. His comrades swarmed him, pounding him on the back and complimenting him. Frank wondered if he was dreaming. It was the best night of his life. Until he saw Gwen.
"Help!"
somebody yelled. A couple of campers rushed out of the fortress carrying a girl on a stretcher. They set her down and other kids started running over. Even from a distance, Frank could tell it was Gwen. She was in bad shape. She lay on her side on the stretcher with a pilum sticking out of her armor, almost like she was holding it between her chest and her arm, but there was too much blood. Frank shook his head in disbelief.
"No, no, no,"
he muttered as he ran to her side. The medics barked at everyone to stand back and give her air. The whole legion fell silent as the healers worked, trying to get gauze and powdered unicorn horn under Gwen's armor to stop the bleeding, trying to force some nectar into her mouth. Gwen didn't move. Her face was ashen gray. Finally, one of the medics looked up at Reyna and shook his head. For a moment, there was no sound except water from the ruined cannons trickling down the walls of the fort. Hannibal nuzzled Gwen's hair with his trunk. Reyna surveyed the campers from her Pegasus. Her expression was as hard and dark as iron.
"There will be an investigation. Whoever did this, you cost the Legion a good officer. Honorable death is one thing, but this..."
Frank wasn't sure what she meant.
Then he noticed the marks engraved in the wooden shaft of the pilum. CHTI, Legio, XIIF. The weapon belonged to the first cohort, and the point was sticking out the front of her armor. Gwen had been speared from behind, possibly after the game had ended. Frank scanned the crowd for Octavian. The Centurion was watching with more interest than concern, as if he were examining one of his stupid gutted teddy bears. He didn't have a pilum. Blood roared in Frank's ears. He wanted to strangle Octavian with his bare hands, but at that moment, Gwen gasped. Everyone stepped back. Gwen opened her eyes. The color came back to her face.
What is it? She blinked. What's everyone staring at?
She didn't seem to notice the 7-foot harpoon sticking out through her chest. Behind Frank, a medic whispered,
There's no way. She was dead. She has to be dead.
Gwen tried to sit up, but couldn't.
There was a river, and a man asking for a coin? I turned around and the exit door was open, so I just left. I don't understand. What's happened?
Everyone stared at her in horror. Nobody tried to help. Gwen, Frank knelt next to her. Don't try to get up. Just close your eyes for a second, okay?
Why? What?
Just trust me. Gwen did what he asked. Frank grabbed the shaft of the pilum below its tip, but his hands were shaking. The wood was slick. Percy, Hazel, help me. One of the medics realized what he was planning.
Don't, he said. You might...
What? Hazel snapped. Make it worse?
Frank took a deep breath. Hold her steady.
1, 2, 3.
He pulled the pilum out from the front. Gwen didn't even wince. The blood stopped quickly. Hazel bent down to examine the wound.
It's closing on its own, she said. I don't know how, but...
I feel fine, Gwen protested. What's everyone worried about?
With Frank and Percy's help, she got to her feet. Frank glowered at Octavian, but the Centurion's face was a mask of polite concern. Later, Frank thought. Deal with him later.
Gwen, Hazel said gently, there's no easy way to say this. You were dead. Somehow you came back.
What?
She stumbled against Frank, her hand pressed against the ragged hole in her armor.
How?
Good question. Reyna turned to Nico, who was watching grimly from the edge of the crowd.
Is this some power of Pluto?
Nico shook his head. Pluto never lets people return from the dead. He glanced at Hazel as if warning her to stay quiet. Frank wondered what that was about, but he didn't have time to think about it. A thunderous voice rolled across the field.
Death loses its hold. This is only the beginning.
Campers drew weapons. Hannibal trumpeted nervously. Scipio reared, almost throwing Reyna.
I know that voice, Percy said.
He didn't sound pleased. In the midst of the Legion, a column of fire blasted into the air. Heat seared Frank's eyelashes. Campers who had been soaked by the cannons found their clothes instantly steam-dried. Everyone scrambled backward as a huge soldier stepped out of the explosion. Frank didn't have much hair, but what he did have stood straight up. The soldier was 10 feet tall, dressed in Canadian Forces desert camouflage. He radiated confidence and power. His black hair was cut in a flat-top wedge like Frank's. His face was angular and brutal, marked with old knife scars. His eyes were covered with infrared goggles that glowed from inside. He wore a utility belt with a sidearm, a knife holster, and several grenades. In his hands was an oversized M16 rifle. The worst thing was that Frank felt drawn to him. As everyone else stepped back, Frank stepped forward. He realized the soldier was silently willing him to approach. Frank desperately wanted to run away and hide, but he couldn't. He took 3 more steps, then he sank to one knee. The other campers followed his example and knelt. Even Reyna dismounted.
"That's good," the soldier said. "Kneeling is good. It's been a long time since I visited Camp Jupiter."
Frank noticed that one person wasn't kneeling. Percy Jackson, his sword still in hand, was glaring at the giant soldier.
"Your Ares," Percy said. "What do you want?"
A collective gasp went up from 200 campers and an elephant. Frank wanted to say something to excuse Percy and placate the god, but he didn't know what. He was afraid the war god would blast his new friend with that extra-large M-16. Instead, the god bared his brilliant white teeth.
"You've got spunk, demigod," he said. "Ares is my Greek form. But to these followers, to the children of Rome, I am Mars, patron of the Empire, divine father of Romulus and Remus."
"We've met," Percy said. We had a fight."
The god scratched his chin as if trying to recall.
"I fight a lot of people, but I assure you, you've never fought me as Mars. If you had, you'd be dead. Now, kneel as befits a child of Rome, before you try my patience."
Around Mars's feet, the ground boiled in a circle of flame.
"Percy," Frank said, "please."
Percy clearly didn't like it, but he knelt. Mars scanned the crowd.
"Romans, lend me your ears."
He laughed, a good, hearty bellow, so infectious it almost made Frank smile, though he was still shivering with fear.
"I've always wanted to say that. I come from Olympus with a message. Jupiter doesn't like us communicating directly with mortals, especially nowadays, but he has allowed this exception, as you Romans have always been my special people. I'm only permitted to speak for a few minutes, so listen up."
He pointed at Gwen.
"This one should be dead, yet she's not. The monsters you fight no longer return to Tartarus when they are slain. Some mortals who died long ago are now walking the earth again."
Was it Frank's imagination, or did the god glare at Nico D'Angelo?
"Thanatos has been chained," Mars announced. "The doors of death have been forced open, and no one is policing them. At least, not impartially. Gia allows our enemies to pour forth into the world of mortals. Her sons, the giants, are mustering armies against you. Armies that you will not be able to kill. Unless death is unleashed to return to his duties, you will be overrun. You must find Thanatos and free him from the giants. Only he can reverse the tide."
Mars looked around and noticed that everyone was still silently kneeling.
"Oh, you can get up now. Any questions?"
Reyna rose uneasily. She approached the god, followed by Octavian, who was bowing and scraping like a champion groveler.
"Lord Mars," Reyna said, "we are honored."
"Beyond honored," said Octavian. "So far beyond honored."
"Well,"
Mars snapped.
"Well," Reyna said, "Thanatos is the god of death, the lieutenant of Pluto?"
"Right,"
the god said.
"And you're saying that he's been captured by giants?"
"Right."
"And therefore, people will stop dying?"
"Not all at once," Mars said. "But the barriers between life and death will continue to weaken. Those who know how to take advantage of this will exploit it. Monsters are already harder to dispatch. Soon they will be completely impossible to kill. Some demigods will also be able to find their way back from the underworld, like your friend Centurion Shish Kebab."
Gwen winced.
"Centurion Shish Kebab?"
"If left unchecked," Mars continued, "even mortals will eventually find it impossible to die. Can you imagine a world in which no one dies, ever?"
Octavian raised his hand.
"But, mighty all-powerful Lord Mars, if we can't die, isn't that a good thing? If we can stay alive indefinitely,
Don't be foolish, boy, Mars bellowed. Endless slaughter with no conclusion? Carnage without any point? Enemies that rise again and again and can never be killed? Is that what you want?
You're the god of war, Percy spoke up. Don't you want endless carnage?
Mars's infrared goggles glowed brighter.
Insolent, aren't you? Perhaps I have fought you before. I can understand why I want to kill you. I'm the god of Rome, child. I am the god of military might used for a righteous cause. I protect the legions. I am happy to crush my enemies underfoot, but I don't fight without reason. I don't want war without end. You will discover this. You will serve me.
Not likely, Percy said.
Again, Frank waited for the god to strike him down, but Mars just grinned like they were two old buddies talking trash.
I order a quest, the god announced. You will go north and find Thanatos in the land beyond the gods. You will free him and thwart the plans of the giants. Beware Gia, beware her son, the eldest giant.
Next to Frank, Hazel made a squeaking sound.
The land beyond the gods?
Mars stared down at her, his grip tightening on his M16.
That's right, Hazel Levesque. You know what I mean. Everyone here remembers the land where the Legion lost its honor. Perhaps if the quest succeeds, and you return by the Feast of Fortuna, perhaps then your honor will be restored. If you don't succeed, there won't be any camp left to return to. Rome will be overrun, its legacy lost forever. So my advice is, don't fail.
Octavian somehow managed to bow even lower.
Lord Mars, just one tiny thing. A quest requires a prophecy, a mystical poem to guide us. We used to get them from the Sibylline books, but now it's up to the augur to glean the will of gods. So if I could just run and get about 70 stuffed animals and possibly a knife...
You're the augur, the god interrupted.
Yes, my lord.
Mars pulled a scroll from his utility belt.
Anyone got a pen?
The legionnaire stared at him. Mars sighed.
200 Romans and no one's got a pen? Never mind.
He slung his M16 onto his back and pulled out a hand grenade. There were many screaming Romans. Then the grenade morphed into a ballpoint pen, and Mars began to write. Frank looked at Percy with wide eyes. He mouthed, "Can your sword do grenade form?" Percy mouthed back, "No, shut up."
There.
Mars finished writing and threw the scroll at Octavian.
A prophecy. You can add it to your books, engrave it on your floor, whatever.
Octavian read the scroll.
This says, go to Alaska, find Thanatos, and free him. Come back by sundown on June 24th, or die.
Yes, Mars said. Is that not clear?
Well, my lord, usually prophecies are unclear. They're wrapped in riddles. They rhyme and...
Mars casually popped another grenade off his belt.
Yes?
The prophecy is clear, Octavian announced. A quest!
Good answer.
Mars tapped a grenade to his chin.
Now, what else? It was something else. Oh, yes.
He turned to Frank.
Come here, kid.
No, Frank thought. The burned stick in his coat pocket felt heavier. His legs turned wobbly. A sense of dread settled over him, worse than the day the military officer had come to the door. He knew what was coming, but he couldn't stop it. He stepped forward against his will. Mars grinned.
Nice job taking the wall, kid. Who's the ref for this game?
Raina raised her hand.
You see that play, ref?
Mars demanded.
That was my kid. First over the wall, won the game for his team. Unless you're blind, that was an MVP play. You're not blind, are you?
Raina looked like she was trying to swallow a mouse.
No,
Lord Mars.
Then make sure he gets the mural crown, Mars demanded. My kid, here,
he yelled at the Legion, in case anyone hadn't heard. Frank wanted to melt into the dirt.
Emily Jong's son, Mars continued. She was a good soldier. Good woman. This kid Frank proved his stuff tonight. Happy late birthday, kid. Time you stepped up to a real man's weapon.
He tossed Frank his M16. For a split second, Frank thought he'd be crushed under the weight of the massive assault rifle, but the gun changed in midair, becoming smaller and thinner. When Frank caught it, the weapon was a spear. It had a shaft of imperial gold and a strange point like a white bone, flickering with ghostly light.
The tip is a dragon's tooth, Mars said. You haven't learned to use your mom's talents yet, have you? Well, that spear will give you some breathing room until you do. You get 3 charges out of it, so use it wisely.
Frank didn't understand, but Mars acted like the matter was closed.
Now my kid, Frank Jong, is gonna lead the quest to free Thanatos, unless there are any objections.
Of course, no one said a word, but many of the campers glared at Frank with envy, jealousy, anger, bitterness.
You can take 2 companions, Mars said. Those are the rules. One of them needs to be this kid.
He pointed at Percy.
He's gonna learn some respect for Mars on this trip, or die trying. As for the second, I don't care. Pick whomever you want. Have one of your Senate debates. You all are good at those.
The god's image flickered. Lightning crackled across the sky.
That's my cue, Mars said. Until next time, Romans. Do not disappoint me!
The god erupted in flames, and then he was gone. Raina turned toward Frank. Her expression was part amazement, part nausea, like she'd finally managed to swallow that mouse. She raised her arm in a Roman salute.
Ave, Frank Jong, son of Mars.
The whole legion followed her lead, but Frank didn't want their attention anymore. His perfect night had been ruined. Mars was his father. The god of war was sending him to Alaska. Frank had been handed more than a spear for his birthday. He'd been handed a death sentence. Chapter 13. Percy. Percy slept like a Medusa victim, which is to say, like a rock. He hadn't crashed in a safe, comfortable bed since, well, he couldn't even remember. Despite his insane day and the million thoughts running through his head, his body took over and said, "You will sleep now." He had dreams, of course. He always had dreams, but they passed like blurred images from the window of a train. He saw a curly-haired fawn in ragged clothes running to catch up with him.
"I don't have any spare change," Percy called.
"What?" the fawn said. "No, Percy, it's me, Grover. Stay put. We're on our way to find you. Tyson is close. At least we think he's the closest. We're trying to get a lock on your position."
"What?"
Percy called, but the fawn disappeared in the fog. Then Annabeth was running along beside him, reaching out her hand.
"Thank the gods," she called. "For months and months we couldn't see you. Are you all right?"
Percy remembered what Juno had said. "For months he has been slumbering, but now he is awake." The goddess had intentionally kept him hidden, but why?
"Are you real?" he asked Annabeth.
He wanted so much to believe it, he felt like Hannibal the elephant was standing on his chest. But her face began to dissolve. She cried,
"Stay put! It'll be easier for Tyson to find you. Stay where you are."
Then she was gone. The images accelerated. He saw a huge ship and a dry dock, workers scrambling to finish the hull, a guy with a blowtorch welding a bronze dragon figurehead to the prow. He saw the war god stalking toward him in the surf, a sword in his hands. The scene shifted. Percy stood on the field of Mars, looking up at the Berkeley Hills. Golden grass rippled and a face appeared in the landscape. A sleeping woman. Her features formed from shadows and folds in the terrain. Her eyes remained closed, but her voice spoke in Percy's mind.
So this is the demigod who destroyed my son Kronos. You don't look like much, Percy Jackson.